and welcome to Real Living. This is Lavinia Spirito and my in the studio with my good friend Mary Lou Nemecek. And we are going to cover in this weekend before the election just a little bit of philosophical foundations as to who we are as a culture of life and as a kingdom of members, hopefully, of the kingdom of God, and the kinds of things that the kinds of challenges that we are being presented in this election, but also I think in everyday life,
yes.
Right? It's funny. I was reading an article yesterday that said something about we have conditioned ourselves as Americans to respond only to crises. So that we're politically involved only every 4 years or every 2 years or whenever the election comes in, and that we examine the issues in the public square really only every 4 years during the presidential elections,
right.
and then we have these violent reactions, and everybody hates this person or loves that person or whatever, and we're vastly polarized. But then after the election,
nothing changes.
We all go home, and nobody continues
right.
to contribute. So basically, I guess the point of the article was we need to really be prepared for our long haul and not for fits and starts, because basically, if we do that, we get the government we deserve.
Are you encouraging us to be Catholics in the public square?
Catholics in the public square, Catholics in the private square, Catholics everywhere. Our allegiance, and first is foremost, and we're going to refer to an article that we're going to read today, is to the Lord Jesus Christ. It's not to a political party. It's not to a political ideology. And as such, I know you and I, Mary Lou, and probably Leo sitting here too, feel progressively and increasingly disenfranchised from the various political philosophies of our day, because really no party really squares with our beliefs. There are certain elements and certain platforms of the
right.
parties, but as such, we can no longer afford to be, you know, wholly given over to the platform of one party or another, just because there's stuff in those platforms in both parties that are not Christian. They're not Catholic, and we have no business supporting them.
Exactly. That's why we need to be encouraged to be a part of this on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are a part of the social, political, spiritual.
Well, we have a right to be there just like everybody else.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, there's this increased marginalization of Christians from the public square. Like, we are driven from the public square if we dare to speak of things in the name of the Lord. And yet, my point is, hey, we have a right to be here just as much as anybody else.
That's
right. The signatories of the Secular Humanist Manifesto, I went back and researched it actually a while back. The Secular Humanist Manifesto was signed originally in 1933, then it was revised in 1973, and then it was represented in 2003. And the Secular Humanist Manifesto begins with, there is no God, there never will be, and we have to not stop looking for salvation in anybody else but ourselves. So there's that. It's
and that
basically
ties into what we're going to talk about.
Exactly. It's Pelagian is what it is. It's like we get to save ourselves. We get to lift ourselves up by our own bootstraps. And there is no human problem that human ingenuity and resourcefulness cannot solve. And there's a heavy emphasis, of course, on technological improvements and how technology is basically going to save us. Now, with various, when John Dewey signed the first secular humanist manifesto, his idea was that education was going to save us. And then in the 1970s, it was political thought is going to save us. And then in 2003, it's technology is going to save us. But it's just this progression of ideas that anything else other than the true thing,
with the absence of God, it's not going to work.
Exactly.
It's going to self-destruct. It's going to cause chaos. And I think we've seen the results of some of that in today's world.
That's right. I wanted to kind of signal everybody an article that I found online on Crisis Magazine, but you can also probably find it on the Catholic Answers Evangelization Conference link on catholicanswers.com or even on the lincolndiocese.org, because this particular article is referring to a talk given by the Bishop of Lincoln, Nebraska, James D. Conley. And it is an address that he gave at this evangelization conference. I thought this was truly, you know, it was very pastoral, it was very humble, it was very, but it was also very pointed. And I think that It should help us as we go to the polls and as we try to engage in public life to kind of understand where we're coming from. You know, I was talking to my husband about this article this morning, and because we've been basically, we just look at each other and we shake our heads, you know, as to where the heck these elections are going. Mm-hmm. What is going on in the Middle East? What is going on with Russia? What, I mean, you know, it's like,
is anyone in control?
What the heck is going on, yeah. Right? Yeah. And we've been talking about this concept of the progressive degradation and disintegration and deterioration, really, of the West. You know, caused by many ways. You know, my husband was pretty philosophical about it. He said, look, the Roman Empire, where is it now? The British Empire, where is it now? You know, I mean, the Empire of Alexander the Great, where is it now? So that's probably a natural cycle. But part of the natural cycle of excellence and being at the apex of everything also, unfortunately, involves people getting too comfortable, too rich, too fat, too happy, and then they fall into
the decay. Is the same today as it was thousands of years
ago. Exactly. Same sort of thing.
Same items.
And at the root of it is a moral decay.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, the moral decay seems to always articulate itself also along sexual lines. So this is a very interesting article because it kind of identifies the sexual revolution as a vehicle of change. This is an address he gave, and he gave an example of James Creighton, who founded Creighton University, but then he says this guy was a true missionary. But then he says, today's America is becoming defined by a kind of utilitarian, technocratic Gnosticism. He says that sounds complicated, but the idea is simple. The moral compass of our political and cultural leaders seem mostly governed by a set of false ideas. Yeah.
Hello.
Like, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins, the government can save you. There's all kinds of things, right? That we can define reality according to our own preferences.
And that's what we see day in and day out.
That we can remake every human relationship according to the power of our wills, and I would add also to the power of our emotions.
Mm-hmm. I feel.
The apostolic.
People don't think.
Writers,
they just feel.
They describe it as passions, mm-hmm. but it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That we have the unconditional right to use technology or wealth to overcome the limitations of our humanity or achieve whatever we think will make us happy. So you want to have an embryo farm somewhere so that should you need it, we can grow an arm for you or a liver that won't have any rejection problems? No problem. As soon as we get the technology to do that, we'll do it. There's no moral reflection on what happens to the embryos that you don't need.
That's right.
You know, what happens when the embryos get discarded?
It's what's best for me, what I think is best for me.
So we have that kind of very frightening idea that we have the technology, we should use it. Well, you know, having it doesn't necessarily mean that we should use it, right? And then it always refers to one of my favorite examples, which I always use. I used it yesterday in the lectures, matter of fact. Justice Kennedy's opinion in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, 1992, is a spectacular example of that self-deception, that idea that I can do whatever I want, I can think whatever I want, and reality has the duty to conform itself to whatever I think it should be.
Well, and let's add that Justice Kennedy is a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So
Irish Catholic. Mm-hmm. That at the heart, this is the quotation, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. You know, how the other guys on the court didn't say, what are you talking about? You
yes.
know, seriously? But therein we see expressed by the highest court of the land this kind of confused, muddled, Gnostic thought. Gnostic means what? Everything is plastic. I can make it up to my own image because matter doesn't matter. Flesh, you know, physical stuff doesn't matter. The only thing under Gnostic thought is the mind matters, soul and spirit.
That
and
secret knowledge
ideas.
That some people have.
That's right. So there is that utilitarian, technocratic Gnosticism. Technocratic because technocracy is our God. Gnostic because we think we can think things into being,
mm-hmm.
like the Almighty.
That's right.
And utilitarian in that the value of you as a human person is only measured by the extent of your accomplishments. And then he goes on, I thought this was an interesting take that this bishop has. The sexual revolution, so of course he's referring to 1968 and forward, told us that freedom means defining the limits of reality for ourselves instead of encountering, understanding, and accepting reality as it is. Which means what? I can have sex with no consequences. I can go out there and I can have unlimited, unbridled sex of any kind with anybody, with any kind of configuration of anybody. And it is my constitutional right to not get pregnant, to not get an STD, and basically to continue on without any, you know, there is no moral overtone. There is no morality.
No,
right?
There is not. It's throwing order out the window, a natural order even.
Those ideas, says Bishop, have roots in the philosophical enlightenment that begat modern democracy. So we can thank the Enlightenment for so many, many positive things, but we cannot thank the Enlightenment for this kind of tip of idea that sexual revolution is going to be the salvation of everything. It took the sexual revolution begun 5 decades ago to tip the balance of that tension and to pose new and serious challenges for Catholics and for our nation. Because in the end, the flashpoint of any feminist argument of anything, it's always abortion, and then contraception. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I as a feminist myself, I think, where did we come to that the fullest expression of being a woman in America today is the right to kill your own child? How is that feminist?
In the womb. It doesn't make any sense.
Right?
No.
To understand the America we live in, we need to understand that the sexual revolution was really an anthropological revolution, meaning a revolution of how we understand ourselves, how we understand our role, how we understand society. When we come back on the other side of the break, we will continue with this discussion. Thank you. Hi, and welcome back to Real Living. We're having a discussion, which I hope is going to be fruitful for those of you who are listening to us, about an article I found called What Every Evangelist Needs to Know, and it's Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. You can find this article at lincolndiocese.org/news/diocesan news, and there's an article that taken from a talk that he gave recently on an evangelization conference. And what he's doing is it's the kind of thing I'm always interested in. How do we get to where we are now? We're all shaking our heads, but how the heck did all this happen?
We didn't see it coming.
Were we sleeping?
I mean,
where were we?
I know.
We've been around a fair amount of time. What happened? So I think it's always interesting to kind of trace back the ideas. This is a continuation. Bishop Conley said, in just a few decades, the sexual revolution has remade most of what America's cultural and political leaders, and I would also add academic leaders, believe about morality. In a culture where life's meaning is self-defined, see Justice Kennedy's opinion in Planned Parenthood, 1992, and technological process can unshackle human desires from the limitations of our bodies, we can have designer children. We can never, ever be pregnant and just pay surrogates to have babies for us. Moral choices seem irrelevant to many people. In place of asking what we ought to do, the only relevant question is, what can we do? Is the technology there yet? I thought that was interesting.
How can we design what we want?
Exactly. And he quotes Neil Postman, quote, driven by the impulse to invent, our culture has at its aim a grand reductionism in which human life must find its meaning in machinery and technique. And I have to say that as an aficionado of science fiction, I love science fiction, I read a lot of it, a lot of these themes are resonating with the kinds of dystopias and science fiction worlds imagined by writers
to define utopia.
50 and 60 years. Mm-hmm. We've had that theme that humanity is becoming irrelevant, that humanity is somehow mm-hmm. going to take a back seat to the technology.
Well, not only
that,
but it's inherently bad in many ways. You know, we're bad for the culture.
Well, ecology.
Or for the environment,
The deep ecology, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and then there's an example he gives. 2 weeks ago, a Silicon Valley technology company announced that it had raised $200 million to begin a new initiative. What is it? Genetically sequencing lab-created embryos in order to deliver children free from major and minor genetic defects. So, designer babies, which
exactly.
is what I said, right?
Exactly.
Cultural leaders say projects like this give freedom for parents to have it all. Political leaders rush to give them grants or tax breaks. But we can't stop to take into account the meaning of what we're doing. we don't consider that projects like these create embryos who are people.
Right.
In laboratories and then leave them to die. We don't consider the costs of remaking and reshaping human life itself. So in this technocracy, ethical concerns are leveled by technological ability, meaning who cares if we should do it? If we can do it, let's do it.
Then it's okay.
Let's worry about it down the road, what the ethical implications are going to be, right?
You keep looking at this. What is the fruits of all of this?
Well,
you know?
the fruit, John Paul II put it very well. It's the war of the powerful against the weak. Because in the end, with the march of technology, with the creation of embryos, with the unlimited access to abortion, with abortifacient contraceptives, with all that kind of stuff, who is it who is suffering? Even with euthanasia, it's the weak. It's the person in the womb. It's the person at the end of life.
It's the handicapped person. Who is ill.
They're the people.
Right.
They're the enemies of progress because what is their contribution? So there you have that meritocracy, basically utilitarian. You get to live only insofar as your contribution is valuable.
And as he says in this article, it reduces people to objects.
Exactly.
Because we really have no value.
Exactly.
You know, we are just social security numbers such and such or, you know, some other identity.
Well, and we're sucking up all kinds of resources the older we get. So basically, we should do away with ourselves. Mm-hmm. Religious liberty is threatened today mostly because when we speak for the vulnerable or for rights of conscience, we dare to call into question the tyranny of progress. The victims of the war of the powerful against the weak are those who cannot contribute to progress or efficiency or profit. If you're in the womb, you haven't quite begun. You will, if you're given a chance, you will contribute, but you don't have a chance yet. If you are ill in a hospital bed and you're towards the end of your life, your contributions may be not measurable according to the standards of the culture. There is very little room in a culture like ours for people who represent inconvenience, who might stand in the way of maximizing happiness. And therefore, the poor, the elderly, the disabled, and the unborn become the main obstacles to progress.
And sadly, we are seeing that.
Euthanasia is already legal in 3 states, and there's no stopping it, I think, at this point. But this is his point. I love this, his point as a shepherd. No one should be afraid of burdening their family because they quote as one of the reasons for euthanasia is that older people, they don't want to be a drain on the resources of the family. They don't want to be a burden, right? And sometimes the older people report that they're afraid of being abandoned. But nobody should be afraid to be a burden to their family. But in the technocratic worldview, there is no greater sin than depending on the help of others. And isn't that true?
And that's where the family comes into play. There needs to be a mother, father, brothers, sisters, grandparents. Mm-hmm. And today, one of the repercussions of all of this is the fact that families are so disjointed.
Mm-hmm.
There's single mothers, single parents, single this, single that. Mm-hmm. And that lends itself to this happening, to people feeling as though that they're burdens.
The fruit of the sexual revolution is a worldview that reduces other people to objects, that sees them as a means to an end or as obstacles to our happiness. If I have this baby right now, I won't get that promotion at work. I already have too many children. This is not the right time for me, whatever. The fruit of the sexual revolution is a culture that tells us that our grandparents are burdens. So when we reduce other people to objects, we lose the relationships that give life meaning, obviously. And that's why we have such alienation in our culture today, right?
And he goes on to say that we lose the ability to love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why everybody's so lonely. Everybody feels so isolated because where's the love here, folks?
Right. And then you have those substitutes like pornography.
Mm-hmm.
Pornography has become a public health crisis in part because the intimacy required in real marital relationships is becoming too difficult and too easily replaced by technologically assisted, isolated self-gratification.
And I have to bring up phones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many times do you go out to dinner and people are sitting there at dinner, they're not speaking to each other, they're looking at their phones and checking things or reading something on their phones. We are becoming more isolated.
The America of today, says Bishop Conley, is a good and beautiful place. The people of our nation are good, earnest, and admirable, but the technocratic revolution of our time, and especially the sexual revolution, has turned on us and revealed deep social, political, and cultural problems that could only be resolved through Jesus Christ. Preach it, Bishop. I think he does such a beautiful job in this.
He does.
He makes 3 main points. How can we help, you know, as missionary disciples? Well, first of all, before we're Americans, before we're even missionaries, before we're anything else, We need to become disciples of Jesus Christ and therefore true friends of Jesus in the church, which goes back to what I was saying earlier. Mm-hmm. Our primary allegiance can't be to a nation or even to a political party. It must be first to our Lord.
And that's the personal relationship we always are mm-hmm. talking about. Mm-hmm. You've got to have that. Mm-hmm. You've got to develop that. You have to be open to that, and you have to be trusting to it.
And you can't give what you don't have.
Exactly.
So before we can proclaim Jesus or witness to him, we need to follow him closely. We need to follow him through the scriptures. Of course, we need to follow him through the church. And we need to learn what he taught and to fall in line and be true disciples, true apprentices of his life, right? We need to also learn that nobody's going to like us for that, that we're going to be signs of contradiction, that people aren't going to appreciate it, right? Each generation, says G.K. Chesterton, is converted by the saint who contradicts it most. I mean, look at St. Francis of Assisi in his corrupt era. Look at even Mother Teresa and saints like Thérèse of Lisieux, who were the saints who were the diametrically opposed. Look at Mother Thérèse of Lisieux was a contemporary of Friedrich Nietzsche.
Right.
Friedrich Nietzsche represents the end of the line of the kind of reasoning that says there is no God because there is no God.
Let's just eat each other
and then die,
right.
You know? And die sitting on a pile of corpses of the mm-hmm. people that you killed. Mm-hmm. But Thérèse is like the anti-Nietzsche.
Right.
Right? And Mother Teresa is also the anti-technocratic, soulless, mm-hmm. Sexual revolution ideas of our time.
To see Jesus in everyone she came in contact
That's
with.
That's right. But isn't it beautiful how the Lord mm-hmm. raises up saints mm-hmm. that seem to be diametrically opposed?
That's what gives us hope, knowing that.
That's right. If we're going to make disciples in this stark, technocratic, lonely culture of American public life, we need to become signs of contradiction. In today's world, that means we are called to embrace what the world rejects. Friendship, beauty, goodness, truth, weakness, suffering, joy, and hope. I find that more and more and more, it's hard for me, not hard, but it's more, people think it's weird when I say, well, that's beautiful. Or there is value in suffering. We can't just knock people on the head because they're suffering. Or, you know, even weak people have value. Or yes, you're my friend. Or yes, I value goodness. You know, I mean, because a lot of people, the vocabulary has changed.
It has.
There's like no more ways of saying this. I like what he says now. Becoming a sign of contradiction is not the same as becoming a contrarian. You know, those mm-hmm. people who like want to be against stuff instead of being for stuff. Evangelization is not a war with the world, which I think many of us could take to heart because a lot of people kind of become a little combative. It's an invitation. It's expressed in love to encounter, serve the living God. Now, I think also what's important is the third point that he says, we need to become signs of contradiction by forming authentic friendships and authentic community. All right, that's the only way. We should expect to face opposition and obstacles, and we should also understand that mercy means nothing. It's just an exercise in sentimentality without clarity about moral truth. Be not afraid of persecution. Live for eternity. Those are the words of encouragement by this bishop.
And we should expect persecution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that hey, it's all a part of it.
Each one of us should take to heart the prayer of Blessed John Henry Newman, who wrote of his life that God has created me to do him some definite service. He has committed some works to me which he has not committed to another. I have my mission. I never may know it in his life, but I shall be told it in the next. Somehow I am necessary for his purpose. I'm a link in a chain, a bond of connection between persons. He has not created me for naught. I shall do good, and I shall do his work. That is our prayer for us, our brothers and sisters. Thanks for joining us.